It is Monday, January the 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Palestinian protest against President Trump, saying that Jerusalem is Israel's capital.
There's been a lot of informal reaction in the form of demonstrations, and the demonstrators have been wounded and several have been killed in protesting it. But it's really just a protest.
Also ahead, false missile warnings in Hawaii, a protest in Iran remembering U.S. civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said Sunday he would only accept a broad, internationally backed panel to broker any peace talks with Israel, but did not rule out a U.S. role in such a panel. Palestinians are seething at President Trump's recognition last month of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, and Abbas told a meeting of senior Palestinian officials in a speech Sunday Mr. Trump's action disqualified the United States as a peacemaker. VOA's Victor Beatty asked American University Middle East scholar and Professor Emeritus Russell Stone if Abbas's remarks were policy or just rhetoric.
It's rhetoric and also an expression of frustration. Trump's declaration on December 6th was unilateral and done without consultation. And it's taken over a month for the Palestine National Council to develop any kind of formal reaction to it. There's been a lot of informal reaction in the form of demonstrations and In fact, demonstrators have been wounded and several have been killed in protesting it. But it's really just a protest.
Again, we've talked before about how relatively muted the reaction has been so far. There's been no real intifada-type uprising.
That's correct. And this is also has to be interpreted as a fairly muted reaction as well. It's rhetoric. It apparently came out in a two-hour-long speech that Abbas gave. But whether it will result in any policy change is rather doubtful. There's certainly been no move to create an alternative international mediation group to replace the United States or to move the peace process forward.
Mr. Abbas, in his remarks, sir, said Israel, through its actions, has effectively ended the 1994 Oslo Peace Accords. Could you explain what they are?
Well, the Oslo Peace Accords were what created the Palestine Authority. So if indeed they were to be abrogated, the Abbas would have no legitimacy whatsoever. So again, this is rhetoric, but not really a move. The Oslo Accords themselves were a set of agreements by which the Palestine Authority recognized Israel. Israel recognized the PA and set out guidelines for moving ahead toward a two-state resolution to the conflict. Nothing has come of it other than the declaration and the mutual recognition.
Of course, Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of President Trump and an advisor, has been trying to spearhead some sort of U.S. Peace effort between Israel and the Palestinians. Is that effectively done?
Well, we have no idea. The only evidence we have is Trump mentioning that it's forthcoming, but whether the Palestinians have seen a draft of it, whether the Israelis have seen a draft of it, and whether they have reacted in any way is not known at this time.
Could international mediation come out of the 2002 creation of the so-called Quartet of Mideast Peace Negotiators, the U.S., Russia, the European Union, and U.N.?
It could, but it hasn't.
Of course, it's 16 years in age now. Is there a prospect that it will be able to pick up this mantle, as Mr. Abbas suggested?
It's doubtful. The fact that so much time has passed, and while there's mention made of it from time to time, neither the people involved in it nor the leadership of Palestine or Israel are giving any credence to it. the so-called quartet of the United States, Soviet Union, I believe Britain, and the European Union. There's somebody else in there. That has been a negotiating body that for which there have been negotiations, but again, no movement toward peace coming from that front either.
Russell Stone, an American University professor emeritus, speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. A blunder blamed on human error caused more than 1 million people in Hawaii to fear that they were about to be struck by a nuclear missile over the weekend. It fed skepticism about the government's ability to keep them informed in a real emergency. Officials continued to investigate the circumstances surrounding the incident in which residents of the westernmost U.S. state in the Central Pacific were erroneously sent emergency alerts. Just a few weeks ago, Hawaii reinstated its Cold War-era alarm sirens amid growing fears of nuclear aggression by North Korea. Hawaii Governor David Ige says the false missile alert that panicked islanders was totally unacceptable, and he told reporters he is angry and disappointed by the situation.
I know firsthand that what happened today was totally unacceptable, and many in our community was deeply affected by this, and I'm sorry for that pain and confusion that anyone might have experienced.
Questioned repeatedly by reporters about how such a mistake could happen, the governor said his administration is doing everything possible to make sure it doesn't happen again. Meantime, Vern Miyagi, administrator of Hawaii's Emergency Management Administration, told reporters the person responsible for the erroneous message feels terrible about it.
The consequence of this is obviously bad. I'm working on credibility now because we've worked so hard to get this in place. That's why I want to tell the public right now is, again, this was a mistake on our part. But don't let that stop as far as the preparation and the warning time if this happens for real.
International Edition's Lori London asked national security expert Jamil Jaffer how a mistake like this could happen in the first place, especially as the U.S. is in the midst of such heightened tensions with North Korea.
Well, look, it is kind of astounding. If you watch the press conference with the Hawaii governor and his director of emergency management, you know, former U.S. Army Major General, General Miyagi, what they said was, look, this was just simply a mistake. They were doing a shift change. During the shift change, they always test the system to make sure it works. The guy clicked on the wrong button. And then even worse, when it said, are you sure you want to do this? He clicked on yes. And so out the signal went. Now, they recovered pretty quickly in the sense that within 13 minutes, they'd start putting the message out on Twitter and the like that this was the wrong message. The problem was they didn't send it out through the same methodology for another 30 minutes, so 40 total minutes. And that's really what caused the problem because everyone got the message on their TVs or on their cell phones, and they didn't get a message the same way until 40 minutes later. And that's something clearly the governor and his director of emergency management are now on top of. They've indicated they're already putting in place procedures to prevent this from happening again and to get the message out faster. But, you know, hindsight's 20/20, of course, in this type of situation.
Absolutely. And from my understanding of what the emergency manager said during that press conference was really if something like this would actually be happening, you'd only have 12 to 13 minutes before the attack.
Well, no, that's exactly right. You know, I mean, typically when we were thinking about this back in the old days in the Russia context, it was typically about a 30-minute notice you'd get from the time Russian missiles were launched, the time they impacted in the United States. So you think about the distances from North Korea to Hawaii, that's exactly right. It's just not a very long time at all. And truth be told, we don't really have those nuclear bomb shelters like we do, like we used to have back in the 80s. Those just aren't active anymore. And so the idea somehow that people are going to be able to get to safety is complicated. You know, I was looking at a chart today, and apparently the best thing to do in these circumstances is to head to the center of the building and as low down as possible. And you can actually reduce your exposure to radiation by significant amounts the lower you go and the more central to a building you get. So, you know, look, if you're at ground zero, obviously that's not going to make a difference. But you know, if you're a distance away and it's about radiation, the best thing you can do is get as deep and as close to the middle of the building as possible, and then just shelter in place until you know, you're given the all clear, which could be, you know, days and weeks. And so you're hoping you have food and water there.
But are we really prepared?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, we are not prepared for the reality of a nuclear strike. But, I mean, the truth is, you know, nuclear exchange so unlikely that the idea of repeatedly being prepared for it, I mean, it's much more likely back in the 60s, 70s, you know, when we had lots of nuclear weapons pointed at each other. By the way, we still have those weapons pointed at each other. They're just there's less likelihood of it happening. But now you have a rogue nation that has these capabilities, could potentially reach the United States, although it's worth noting that North Korea has still not demonstrated the capability of sending a nuclear weapon up into space and make it successfully through reentry to the Earth, which is what you'd need to get to the United States. And so that they haven't shown the ability to do that, nor, frankly, the ability to mount a nuclear device on top of a missile, both of which are big things that need to be done before you can deliver this kind of capability. So we're still maybe a ways away from that, at least a ways away from demonstrating that. But, yeah, I mean, this is a real thing, and this is why, in particular, I think we've got to change our policy towards North Korea, because the idea of North Korea, a fundamentally unstable nation, you know, with nuclear weapons that can reach the United States, is just an unacceptable thing from an American perspective.
Could this have provided North Korea with vital information on what the U.S. would do about an incoming ballistic missile?
Well, I mean, I think it tells them how unprepared we are, but I think, you know, I think nobody's surprised to hear that. I think what it doesn't tell them is what the response would look like if this were to happen. I think it's fair to say, I think the North Koreans probably know this, but I think it's worth underlining for them that, you know, the response to any sort of an attack, conventional or nuclear, but certainly nuclear, would be so massive and so catastrophic and so rapid that it would just not be worthwhile for the North Korean leadership to engage in such an activity. And so at the end of the day, I think they realize that a nuclear exchange with the United States is not one they would win. And frankly, you know, the idea that they should even begin threatening that, I think, is really problematic. And, of course, that's already begun.
Does it show, though, how close the line really is between a mistake and nuclear war?
Well, that's certainly true. You know, we have a lot of fail-safes in place for the release of nuclear weapons, right? So once the president gives the go order, which itself takes a while because he's got to get the nuclear football, open it up, identify the codes, identify the targets, then transmit that information from the National Command Authority, of which the president is the lead, through the National Military Command Center to the forces in the field. Then they have a fail-safe system involving sort of, at least back in the old days, it was twin keys, right? Two people have to insert their keys separately. You can imagine a world in which to trigger the alarm, you might have a two-key system or a fail-safe. Here you had one person could do it. It did take two clicks, clearly not enough to stop the alert from going out. But, you know, it's funny because we all have succumbed to that two-click problem, right, where you're like, send an email, are you sure you want to do this? And you say yes, and you're like, wait, I don't actually want to do that. And so, you know, you sort of feel bad for the guy that this happened to, but it doesn't make it any better for the hundreds and thousands of Hawaiians who were, you know, reasonably in a state of panic for that 40-minute period and running for cover.
That is national security expert Jamil Jaffer speaking with my colleague, Lori London. The Iranian government has acknowledged 25 people have been killed during recent anti-government protests in cities throughout that country. Protests erupted over economic issues, but grew into widespread unrest condemning the Islamic regime as a whole, with attacks on government and police buildings. Meantime, over the weekend, Iran said it would retaliate for new sanctions imposed by President Trump. That story now from Reuters' Lucy Fielder.
The U.S. president also reluctantly signed the waiver on nuclear sanctions for what he said was the last time on Friday, giving Washington and its European allies a last chance to fix what he called disastrous flaws in the pact reached under Barack Obama. The new sanctions target 14 Iranian entities and people. They crossed all red lines, Iran's foreign ministry said, and violate international law. But it didn't clarify how Tehran might hit back. Trump chafed at having to sign the deal again and wants it strengthened with a separate agreement within 120 days to keep Washington in. His conditions include immediate inspections at all sites requested by international experts and making any Iranian missile testing subject to severe sanctions. Iran says its nuclear program is peaceful. Trump's ultimatum puts pressure on European backers of the nuclear deal to satisfy Trump if they want it to hold. One diplomat telling Reuters it would be complicated to save it after this.
That is Reuters' Lucy Fielder reporting. Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day here in the United States. It's a federal holiday marking his birthday. Martin Luther King was the chief spokesperson for nonviolent activism in the U.S. civil rights movement, which successfully protested racial discrimination in federal and state law. The campaign for a federal holiday in King's honor began soon after he was assassinated in 1968. President Ronald Reagan signed the holiday into law in 1983, and it was first observed 3 years later. Guy Carawan was instrumental in the work King did on behalf of civil rights. The singer-songwriter introduced the song We Shall Overcome to the civil rights movement by teaching it to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1960.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do. How about you all try it with me? We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart.
Martin Luther King Jr. knew the civil rights movement needed a soundtrack. The civil rights movement incorporated jazz, folk, R&B, and gospel to use music that everybody could relate to and to inspire and help change America in the 1950s and 60s. Along with Guy Carawan, there were numerous notable singers who were part of King's soundtrack: Harry Belafonte, Nina Simone, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Bob Dylan, Curtis Mayfield, just a few of the many who were among them. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have found 8 sites on Mars that suggest there are a number of very big chunks of water ice that make their way deep within the surface of the red planet. The U.S. Geological Survey-led study, using high-resolution imagery and topography from NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, gathered never-before-seen details about ice sheets on Mars. The images and data reveals that some of the observed ice chunks begin within a few meters below the surface of Mars and are thought to extend to more than 91 meters in depth. The study's lead author, Colin Dundas, a scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey, says there's ice under about a third of the Martian surface. While previous missions already revealed the existence of water ice deposits on Mars, this new study provided an analysis of the vertical structure and thickness of the ice sheets. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It is time now for a little something from the world of music.
Well, life on the farm is kind of laid back. Ain't much an old country boy like me can't hack. It's early to rise, early in the sack. I thank God I'm a country boy. Well, a simple kind of life never did me no harm. Raising me a family and working on the farm. Days are all filled with an easy country charm. Thank God I'm a country boy. Well, I got me a fine wife, I got me old fiddle. When the sun's coming up, I got cakes on the griddle. Life ain't nothing but a funny, funny riddle. Thank God I'm a country boy.
That's Henry John Deutschendorf Jr., better known to many of us as John Denver. He was an American singer, songwriter, record producer, actor, activist, and humanitarian. This song, Thank God I'm a Country Boy, was one of Denver's biggest hits. He recorded and released 300 songs, most of them he composed himself, with sales of more than 30 million records worldwide.
My life for diamonds or jewels. I never was one of them money-hungry fools. Rather have my fiddle and my farming tools. Thank God I'm a country boy. Yeah, city folk driving in a black limousine. A lot of sad people thinking that's a mighty keen. Son, let me tell you now exactly what I mean. I thank God I'm a country boy.
On one of his many television specials, John Denver told the story of his first guitar. It was his grandmother's 1910 Gibson. She gave it to him when he was 11 years old, and then he sang This Old Guitar.
This old guitar taught me to sing a love song, showed me how to laugh and how to cry. It introduced me to some friends of mine and brightened up some days. Help me make it through some lonely nights. Oh, what a friend to have on a cold and lonely night. This old guitar gave me my lovely lady. It opened up her eyes and ears to me. It brought us close together, and I guess it broke her heart. But it opened up the space for us to be. What a lovely place and a lovely space to be.
John Denver was born in 1943 into a military family in the U.S. city of Roswell, New Mexico. His father, Dutch, was an Air Force test pilot, and the family moved to many locations while he was in the military. Denver began his singing career with folk music groups. That was during the late 1960s. And starting in the 1970s, he was one of the most popular acoustic artists of the decade, and one of the best-selling artists as well.
I love to sing my songs for you. Yes, I do, you know. I love to sing my songs for you. Thank you for sharing this evening with us, my friends. Good night.
Denver was married twice. His first wife, Annie Martell, inspired many of his big hits, including Annie's Song, and his second wife was Australian actress Cassandra Delaney. Both of those marriages ended in divorce. They had three children. Among his many avocations, John Denver loved to pilot his own plane. And it was on October 12, 1997, when he was just 53 years old, his experimental plane, known as the Long EZ, crashed into Monterey Bay near Pacific Grove, California. Denver died in that crash. So many remember him today by listening to his numerous hits, such as one of his favorites, Grandma's Feather Bed.
When I'm when I was a little bitty boy, just up off the floor. We used to go out to Grandma's house every month in the soul. Half chicken pie and country ham, homemade butter on the bread. But the best darn thing about Grandma's house was a great big feather bed. It was 9 feet high and 6 feet wide, soft as a downy chick. It was made from the feathers of 411 geese, took a whole bolt of cloth for the tick. It'd hold 8 kids, 4 hound dogs, and a piggy we stole from the shed. Didn't get much sleep, but we had a lot of fun on Grandma's feather bed. After supper, we'd sit around the fire, the old folks would spit and chew. Pa would talk about the farm and the war, Granny'd sing a ballad or two. And I'd sit, listen, watch the fire till the cobwebs filled my head. Next thing I know, I'd wake up in the morning in the middle of the old feather bed.
It's a bit of a song of my youth. My grandmother had a big feather bed. I even helped pick feathers off the... Well, anyway, long story. Thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from John Denver.
Well, I love my mom, I love my pa, I love Granny and Grandpa, too. I've been fishing with my uncle, I wrestled with my cousin, I even kissed a blue. But if I ever had to make a choice, I guess it ought to be said. I'd trade them all, plus a gal down the road for Grandma's feather bed. Yes, I'd trade them all, plus a gal down the road. Well, maybe I better reconsider about the gal down the road. It was 9 feet high, 6 feet wide, soft as a downy chick. It was made from the feathers of 411 geese, took a whole bolt of cloth for the tick. Did hold 8 kids, 4 hound dogs, and a piggy we stole from the shed. Didn't get much sleep, but we had a lot of fun on Grandma's feather bed. Didn't get much sleep, but we had a lot of fun on Grandma's feather bed.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the third day of each January, Americans honor the memory of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. King, a Baptist minister from the southern state of Alabama, was a leader in the U.S. civil rights movement, advocating social change through nonviolent means. On January 15th, he would have celebrated his 86th birthday. Believing that change does not roll in on the wheels of inevitability, but comes through continuous struggle, Dr. King organized and participated in mass action boycotts, sit-ins, peaceful marches, and other nonviolent acts of civil disobedience. Dr. King once stated that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for the law. And so activists, sometimes deliberately, but peacefully and respectfully, broke laws aimed at segregating the white citizenry from the non-white, thus hoping to bring attention to the inherent unfairness of such legislation. Thus, when a black seamstress named Rosa Parks broke the law in Montgomery, Alabama, by refusing to give up her seat on a bus to a white passenger and subsequently was jailed for her transgression, her plight generated national attention and increasing sympathy for her cause across the country. Dr. King's and the civil rights movement's greatest achievements came in 1964 with the passage of the Civil Rights Act, which outlawed segregation in public places, as well as employment discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, gender, or national origin. The Civil Rights Act spawned the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which forbids racial discrimination in voting, and the 1968 Fair Housing Act, which prohibits discrimination in housing and financing for the purchase of a home based on race and national origin. Dr. King was 39 years old when he died by an assassin's bullet on April 4, 1968. But his legacy lives on. In the fullness of time, segregationist laws were repealed. Discrimination is a legally punishable and punished offense. Dr. King's life is well summed up in his own words. The quality, not the longevity of one's life, is what is important.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
From Washington, this